I am talking to you.
So, as Jude said, I'm going to be talking about cosmology, which is what I study. Some of you I know have heard a little bit about cosmology in your sessions, depending on which group you were in. Who are in those group cosmology groups? These people over here. All right. Well, I'll expect you all to answer all of the questions that I ask during the talk. I'll be sure to point you out again if you fail to answer this question. Just joking. Okay, so I am going to talk about cosmology, but first I'll just introduce myself. So you might be able to read my name tag, which is hanging on the computer. But if you can't, my name is Mark Wyman. I'm from the United States. I'm from Louisiana, a southern state on the Gulf of Mexico. So I'm just going to, where people are from is sort of an important fact about them, I generally find. So I was just going to go ahead and put myself on a map of the world. So that's the globe. And this is going to be relevant in a minute, but I'm going to just use something like a Mercator projection. It was actually, believe it or not, it's going to be related to cosmology. And I can't draw, really, so I'm just going to use straight lines. Florida. So here's North America. It's not bad, right? And South America, too. Sorry. And remember, since this is a math talk, I can do anything I want. So all of these points along up here are identified because it's a globe, right? That's the pole. All right, so I'm from here, roughly. So I don't know, most people, nobody else from Louisiana here, huh? Southern US? No? That's too bad. What? Mexico. All right, that's great. That's pretty close. Okay, maybe I should have made Mexico a little bit bigger there on the map. So where in Mexico? Huh? Where in Mexico? Oh, cool. What? All right, I'm not really sure what was that funny about that, but I have to figure it out. All right, well, we can just keep on that theme. So we got one from Mexico. So who else from North America, though, in general? You? What? U.S.? Okay, then lower your hands if you're not from the U.S. That was a test. That was you all kind of failed, but that's okay. It's warning. All right, so a lot of you from the U.S., South America? Where? Brazil. Okay, cool. From a big city or a little city? What?
Small city.
Which is? Okay, well, at least one person from down here then. All right, so now we can move to the, so then we have Europe. I don't see. So it'll wrap around.
Europe's a box.
Yeah. Okay, and so then. So that'll be Europe. This is teaching you an important lesson. Up till now in your life, you thought it was important to draw a map accurately. But now, what I'm going to try to tell you is that from a cosmologist's perspective, just having those sort of particular details are not necessary. As long as somebody knows them, you don't necessarily have to know them yourself, which is true, right? I mean, do we really need for like identifying who's from Europe? Raise your hand. Europe, Europa. Okay, smaller class from Europe, I guess. But I mean, for that, do we need to have like? I mean, do I need to get like nail really the? I mean, include Britain, for instance. I mean, no. You learned a lot about that. So just to finish off our tour of the continents, Antarctica. Okay. Well, if you become cosmologists, then some of you might go live there because there's a lot of cosmology done from Antarctica, which we can talk about if we have time. Africa. Anybody? One. Wow. Okay, great. Almost as many Africans as Europeans. And lastly, Asia, which is really done badly by this. Well, no, it starts here, right? It wraps around. It's kind of... What?
I'm from New Zealand. And so
oh, okay. Oh, yeah. So New Zealand is... So this, I guess, would be Tasmania. So New Zealand would be out here, huh? Great. Where in New Zealand? The southern or the northern part? Great. I have a very good friend in graduate school who was from New Zealand, so I heard lots about New Zealand, and I was already very much fussed out. I should have included. I should have started with New Zealand, in fact. Yeah. I did. The Caribbean is here. But. At the level of approximation I'm losing, the Caribbean is completely devoid of islands. I'm sorry, but you must be very good swimmers. Okay. All right, so I've managed to insult half of the audience now. I'm sorry about that. I'm not really that sorry. Okay, so here's the equator, roughly, right? That's, well, just showing how bad my map is. Something like that. Anyway, so there's the equator. So this map, I'm going to use this map to make a little point about geometry, which it doesn't seem like I've done right now. But I gave you some fake talk about how I was going to use this to talk about not needing to know details. So that's also important, not knowing details. But so I told you that all the top points and all the lower points were all identified, right? But in the middle of the map, it's not such a bad approximation, this flat thing, right? So I can draw a line up here connecting to the North Pole right through the Pacific, probably cutting through somebody's home island. And I can draw that line, and it makes a 90-degree angle with the equator, yeah? All right, so if I draw another line to the Atlantic, sort of, that's also going to be 90 degrees, right? How many degrees in the triangle? What? Less than 270 on my sphere. Someone's more than 180 in the sphere. Very good. Okay, so we all know. So everyone seems to know this fact, but and so you can see it manifest here, right? Because this perpendicular line and this perpendicular line actually met here, right? Like these points are the same. So it's kind of a cool fact. And it turns out that this sort of I mean, obviously spherical geometry has been important for the history of naval navigation and other kind of navigating things. Not to mention knowing the fact that the Earth is round. But that's not really so relevant for most of us. I mean, obviously many of you have traveled and seen the curvature of the Earth on your plane flight here, but you didn't really have to know that, right? I mean, as long as the pilot knew. Anyway, so the point is, though, that this curve thing is actually the central, one of the central facts about the entire, about space, which is that, so we all know that, like, you know, in flat space, you can add up this angles of a triangle, and it adds to 180. And all of you very clever people know that on spheres, that the sum of the angles is bigger than 180, and then on hyperbolic structures, the sum of the angles is what? Less. Very good. So the question is, what makes these curves happen, right? So on the Earth, what's made the Earth shape like it is? Somebody answer that question? Yes, gravity has made the shape like that. But what actually makes these curves add up, these triangles add up to being more than 180 degrees? What fact about these lines that I've drawn? It's a really simple fact. You're probably all thinking too hard. That's right, because these lines are constrained to lie on the surface of the Earth, right? That's whenever I drew this bad map, I made the assumption that the flat map was going to be stuck to the surface, right? But no one told. I mean, even though we all kind of agree on that to start with, no one told you I couldn't make this triangle by drawing a straight line that cut through the surface of the Earth and went to the North Pole, right? So if I redraw the sphere, and start here and here, if I follow the surface of the Earth, it's a 90-degree angle. But if I go straight through the Earth and go to the pole, what's the sum of that triangle going to be? 180. How do you know that? So what's flat, though? The path is flat? The plane of the triangle is flat. Okay, so why do you think these planes are flat? All right, so you decided the plane. So I'm trying to get you to say something about. So you decide the plane is flat, and then you get a triangle that's 180, or do you start by assuming the triangles be 180 and then define the plane that will make that true? Can anyone tell me if those are distinct questions, or are they identical? That's pretty good, but it's actually, this is an important question. It sounds like I'm belaboring this point, which I am a little, but the key fact is that you've heard about this thing about gravity being the curvature of space. And it turns out that you can't always define that this question of defining what a flat plane is actually quite a difficult one whenever gravity actually enters the scene. Not in grabbing a bunch of stones and making them form into an almost spherical shape, which is the Earth, but by actually curving the background of space itself. And so this fact that gravity is the law that governs the curvature of space is actually one of the central facts about cosmology. So let me see. I want to go about this. So let me just give you a little counterexample to this. That's from my own research. That's only tangentially related to what the ostensible subject of my talk is. And that's like, imagine, if you will. This is a real line now. So imagine if you have a line in space that has a linear mass density. So you probably. Does anybody know what a linear mass density is? Can anyone guess what a linear mass density is? Define, but just a simple definition. Just what's the unit? What's the units?
Well, I guess if you're in mass density, then grams per.
Grams per.
Linear volume of space, right?
Linear mass density. Okay. Well, the point what I'm looking for is just bad language. Just grams per centimeter, or just weight, linear mass density. I know these questions are too easy. I'm sorry. I'm gonna have to ask the other half of the room to start answering. So the point is, okay. So let's just take something that's measured in a mass per unit length, and let's take that mass per length to be 10 to the 20. That's 10 with 20 zeros. Grams per centimeter. That's pretty heavy. Yeah? Mm-hmm. You know anything that weighs 10 to the 20 grams? Anybody? Mm-hmm. Anything? Oh, those are all a lot heavier than that. So good guess though. I can't think of anything that actually weighs 10 to the 20. There's probably some asteroid or something. Anyway, but so let's imagine a line in space that has this crazy high mass density. It turns out that if you put this in gravity, the gravitational equation, let me just go ahead and write everything that you need to know about gravity in one short line. In fact, this is all that we know about. So, that's gravity. All right. Now you're done with your general relativity course. I'm going to go back. Does anybody have any questions about this? I'm being facetious. This is Einstein's equation, written in plain language. You have a suitably defined curvature. Suitably defined requires several graduate courses, and you set that equal to some number, which you all know as Newton's constant. Times some suitably defined energy density, then you know how gravity works. At least how gravity works until you get to really small length scales, which you probably heard about in some other. So there's a string theory keynote, yeah?
Yeah.
Who gave it? Was it? Freddie. What did he talk about? Anyway, so if you take this equation, that was a smart ass answer. I like that. So if you take this curvature scale and you make this curvature scale really, really, really big, then you get to string theory. But to be honest, nothing has ever been measured that requires any equation other than this one, which is Einstein's equation. And so it turns out if for your energy density on the right hand side here, if you put a line of space that's really heavy, then the answer of the equation, then the curvature answer is a really peculiar one. And that curvature answer is that space, flat planes, these flat planes that everyone seemed to be confident that they could draw, don't exist in the usual way. That any flat plane that you try to cut through space, that goes behind this line, that if you make a triangle that goes around this line in space, then the number of the total sum of the angles there is going to be, can anyone guess if it's bigger or less than 180? Can we have a vote? Bigger? Bigger. Come on, everybody has to vote. But of course, you may be voting for the other thing. So then that means that less is, yes. Come on, there's a lot of you didn't vote. Come on. I know you stayed up late, but you can at least participate.
In which direction is the curvature?
What?
Which direction is the curvature, and then which side is the?
Well, you're on the inside.
It's I think it's unambiguous, but just the inside angles, let's just say it.
What?
Just the inside angles of the triangle.
Measure pole.
If you got your whatever you call it, the thing of measuring out at the three corners of the triangle, and you measure the angles, if you want, would you sum it and get more or less than
180? I know.
Well, that would be trying to. I'll get you. If you're getting you to try to guess what kind of curvature it will be.
Well, I think that what kind of curvature are we talking about?
Sorry. I'll stop making you guess on this. The point is that actually you get less than this because you can also get like. So she is right. Of course, it's always the same question. This is a useful. What's your name?
Anna.
What?
Anna.
Anna. Okay. Anna has taught us a useful question. Probably the most useful skill for attending a physics lecture for the rest of your life, you can remember this. If you ask a question like that, which is a good question, then everybody else in the room will probably think you're smart. So I know that you don't think that, but this is actually a true fact. And you can all examine your own consciences later and decide if you go to a talk and someone asks a question that you maybe understand or maybe don't, if you think that they're smarter or dumber. And you can probably find out, but you usually assume that they're smarter, unless they ask something like, can I go to the bathroom? Okay. So the point is, this actually, what actually happens is that by putting a heavy line in space, which you force, I was talking about being forced to be constrained to live on the surface of the sphere if you're on the Earth. It turns out that having these lines in space makes you forced to live on the surface of a cone. So that space is not flat. Well, it's flat everywhere except for at the tip of the cone. If you think about, you tried to make that's sort of a technical thing. But this is just a little example. These are called cosmic strings, by the way. And that's what I did my PhD thesis on, because these may exist in the real world. So the point, though, is that
are these strings in the center?
That's an excellent question, and no one, maybe, it's a definite maybe. The point is that strings in string theory are usually exist at a really small length scale, very, very small. Whereas a cosmic string in this sense would be something that would be as long as the universe is big. And so for them to be the same takes some magic. That magic may actually happen in the real world. We don't know yet. It's never been observed. It's just a theoretical construct. Yes?
What kind of difference does it make whether we have just this cosmic string or just one point? Because when it goes through this space, and say that our space is this flat plane, then it just has, then just hits this space at one point, and therefore we could just take this point. We wouldn't need the string itself.
That's a very good point. So that's exactly, in fact, the easiest way to solve these equations. If you just take a plane and then do gravity in two dimensions, two spatial dimensions, then you get the same answer. Yeah, they're the equivalent.
But why
do you need the string? Yes, you do need the string. Because a point, the Earth is a point. Okay? Well, approximately. It's a first approximate point. But this isn't true around the Earth. So to in three dimensions, for this effect to happen, the thing has to be extended in the second third, in the one dimension direction, turns out. Just trust me. OK, one more question, I have to go to the point of my talk.
OK, what if you study background radiation from like early enough in the universe so that you can find cosmic strings where an energy density is high enough for those lengths to exist?
Can you read my thesis? That was one of my PhD. The large one, the longest chapter of my PhD thesis was on that question.
Okay.
And the answer
I'll
is
pick up a copy.
Yeah, it's a hot seller. You can find it on Amazon. Not really. But the answer is very technical and beyond the scope of the present lecture, which is what physicists say whenever they haven't prepared anything to say. And so I would just stand here and mutter for a while, and everyone would really hate me. So I'm not going to answer that. But later, you can ask me that question later, and I'll give you more than you ever wanted to know about it. Okay, so this is all background about curvature, space, and gravity. So this has all been fairly local. I mean, the Earth is a pretty small place compared to the size of the universe. It's a very important place. Don't let anyone tell you that being small in the cosmos means being unimportant. Not true. But whenever you talk about cosmology, the Earth is pretty small beings. So because one of the questions we'd like to answer as a cosmologist is this question about flatness, except on the whole universe scale. So the question is, so I'm pretty confident that I can draw a triangle with me and a couple of you, and it'll be flat, right? And I know a lot about this like curvature of the Earth thing. But we have another question that we can ask, which is, what if we look at the whole universe? What if I draw a line between me, some really distant galaxy, and some other really distant galaxy? Would you all be confident that that triangle would have 180 degrees?
Yes?
Yes? So that's one yes. Who would be confident that it had 180 degrees? OK, so why would you think it was confident? Why are you confident of that?
I don't know. It just seems that we wouldn't be able to.
I'm not asking about whether you can notice it. I'm just asking fundamentally: is it different than 180? You don't have to know. I'm asking you to guess. And you raised your hand, so I picked on you. I'm sorry. So this is actually one of the key questions of cosmology, since cosmology was invented about 100 years ago by the incidental as an incidental byproduct of Einstein's theory of gravity, which is. I say it's an incidental byproduct because whenever everybody thought about gravity before, people thought about Newton, the Earth, apple falling, everything. We're worried maybe about, you probably heard the famous story about the very first successful prediction of general relativity was the motion of Mercury around the sun, right? Heard that? Yeah, okay. So, but that's small, right? But so the amazing thing about this formula, though, is that if you stick in so energy density, sun and Mercury, then you get some answer that worked. But if you put in energy density equals everything that is, then what do you get on the left-hand side? And so that actually is the question of cosmology. If your energy density, I'm just going to shorten it to energy now, is like everything. Then you have a weird question, right? Because what does it even mean for everything to generate some curvature of everything, right? So there's basically, as we've already discussed, three kind of answers that you can get. everything can be flat, everything can be positively curved, or everything can be negatively curved. Positively curved, like a sphere, and negatively curved is like a saddle shape. Yeah. Well, there's no way you can know until you try, right? I mean, how did we find out that it was good for local stuff? We guessed it, and we put in the stuff, and then we saw what the answers came up, right? Okay, so for the whole universe, I mean, that's an excellent question, and one of the basic questions of cosmology being, let me just go ahead and define it on the board. So it's the study of the universe as a whole, right? I say right, but maybe you've never heard this ever. So the basic question of cosmology is that equation right for the whole universe? That's probably the most basic question in cosmology, because there's no other game in town when you get to like the size of galaxies. I mean, electromagnetism is really important. It's much stronger than gravity, but there's not any big charge blobs in galaxies pushing stuff around. And so what about galaxies being attracted to other galaxies? Or this whole question that I'm talking about is like the energy density of everything, making the Earth and making all of space have a curvature. Did somebody have a question? Okay. So it turns out I'm gonna cut to the punchline, which is that about 7 years ago we got the answer, the people who wanted to say that it was a flat triangle, like a 180-degree triangle, are correct. But that was not known. I mean, a lot of people had that prejudice, and it is a prejudice. It turned out to be an accurate prejudice. Not all. And so an accurate prejudice that everyone had, that the space was flat everywhere. But we didn't actually know that on the biggest scales until very, very recently. I mean, it turns out basically the way we learned it is by figuring out, if you look at these equations, this curvature side is basically a bunch of rules that takes local like measurements of distances and relates them, and like how they change in the presence of different kinds of energy density. So that's basically what those equations are, equations of gravity. They're really hard to solve, though. Nobody can solve equations of gravity easily. And all of the famous solutions that you'll learn about in your textbooks were guesses. Which is kind of, I still find this kind of an amazing fact, which is why I'm telling you, is that like the single most famous equation, solution of these equations is the Schwarzschild solution, which is the solution for the curvature of space around a black hole, or any spherical body, but in particular a black hole. You've heard of the Schwarzschild radius, I guess. So this equation, and it's really, it's quite beautiful. I'm not gonna write it down for you because it's complicated, but it was totally a guess. I mean, they just sort of like, you kind of guess what maybe it's going to look like, and you stick it in the equations and see if you get a zero at the end. And so this is basically the state of the art of general relativity. And you have to be really clever to do that, but that's how it works. Anyway, so I just bring this up as a side point to tell you that once you get to the forefront of theoretical physics, it works a lot differently from the equations you solve in physics class. In physics class, there's usually some algorithm you use, right? You learn, if I have an F equals MA equation problem, I do this, right? But that's not, whenever you get to the forefront, it works in a completely different way. It's really interesting. Is that you have these equations, and you just kind of fool around with them until you find some new solution. And so then what happens is you have your new solution, and then this is actually the way that it proceeds. You find a solution, and then you go see in the world if there's something like it, which is kind of cool. And that was how it happened with black holes, that people found the solution for black holes many decades before any black holes were actually seen in the universe. And so there's a venerable tradition of getting lucky in your guesses. For myself, I can just tell you that there's something called the Wyman solution to some equations that are related to this. Not really, they haven't yet been found to apply to anything. But I've got my money that somewhere out there in the universe, that's going to describe something. So my name will be famous, even though it wasn't me. Though I'm lucky enough that the guy who came up with it had the same first initial as I do. So if people don't look very carefully, they might think it was me. Well, that, and they don't look at the birth date, because I think the paper is from the 60s. So maybe they'll just think I'm really young looking. Okay, so it turns out that this local question that you very cleverly put your finger on is the key fact that lets us make some progress here. So what she meant by a local question is that can you find the answer without by just looking around you? Can you have to sort of like sum up everything that you see sort of simultaneously over multiple times to get the answer? It turns out you do not. You can do it locally. So the question of the energy density of everything, density is the key component, which I did omit here foolishly, because you can measure an energy density right here, like in a box like here. Of course, it's going to be a bad, if you want to get the general behavior of the universe as a whole, measuring the energy density in this room is going to be a bad approximation, because most of space is in or out of the Earth's atmosphere. What? These aren't very clear answers for a very easy question. Come on. Out. Very good. Thank you. So the question is, what do you think the background energy density of space is in grams per centimeter cubed? Does anybody know? Have a guess? What? Now, the people who learned it shouldn't guess. Come on. So it's going to be okay. I'll give you a hint. It's 10 to the sum power. Can I get a couple of guesses? I'm going to call on people.
-12.
-12. Okay, there we go. That's one guess.
-10.
You knew this already. See, I told people who know not to guess. Anyway, -29 is the right answer. Due to unfortunate cheating by some of the members of the class. It's not really cheating. Grant at CGS. Oh, just another aside for you, that astronomers particularly like to call the metric system CGS or KMS. CGS stands for centimeters, grams, seconds. KGS is kilometers, meters, seconds. Yeah.
Is this just matter and energy?
Sorry?
Is this just matter and energy, or are you including dark energy?
Everything.
Everything.
Background density. Total. So.
How do you calculate that?
Well, then you measure the curvature, and you put it. So this is you're anticipating what I'm going to say next, which is that. So this is the answer, and then you ask what the question is. And so, the thing is that can you measure energy density or curvature more easily? The answer is you can measure curvature more easily because of these triangles that I was talking about. It turns out that there are some really nice triangles that you can draw. So. If I wanted to figure out something about a triangle, and I was looking like, here I am, here's my head, so I'm looking that way. My arm, you can think about my arm sticking out that way. So this is a top-down view, and I can measure this angle right here. If I knew the length of the opposite side of what I was looking at. Then I could figure out whether that triangle was what the shape of that triangle is. So it turns out, and so one of the most important questions in cosmology is an astronomy question, which is, is there anything in astronomy that you can look at a very great distance, and know from just looking at it how big it is? This seems to have impressed everyone into silence. This is known as the question of a standard ruler, I think. Anyway, it'll serve for now. It may be not what people used to call it. But so the question is there anything whose intrinsic length you know? Like, if you saw, like, one easy thing would be is if you could see a meter stick, right? Like, just, or like a yardstick, just stuck out in space. Just some standard object that had a little inscribed on it said, I am 1 meter wide. Right? Then you could figure out a lot, because you could look at it and if you could figure out how far away it is, if you could figure out this distance, so the sort of the distance away, and how wide it was, then you could use these two facts plus the angle you measure here to figure out all the angles of this triangle, right? Yes? That a neutron star, actually, well, you've actually stumbled on something, the other standard thing that I wanted to talk about. But this, the problem with a neutron star is it would be great, except it's too small. This L would be very well known, but way too small to get, the angle would be roughly zero. And so you can't, so zero is a bad angle, unfortunately. So it needs to be big, because this distance here is going to be things like 100 million light years. So a neutron star is about as big as New Jersey. And 100 million light years away is not very wide. Okay? And so, this is one of the basic questions of physics. And I'll just tell you that we have the answer. We found several such standard rulers that I can't go into today, but I can tell you what it is. It's just the cosmic microwave background radiation. So you all know about the Big Bang model, which is the universe started out small and then expanded, right? And it's actual spheres, but my drawing prohibits me from doing that. So, yes.
Of space itself, and therefore
there was,
and this looks like there's something like a,
well,
more space around it in which it
expanded,
but it wasn't there, therefore.
Yeah. That's a deep conceptual question that I'm not going to be able to explain to you right now, but it works. Believe me, it actually, it's fine. Well, I mean, this is actually another one of these things about, like I was telling you about not needing to know the details. Yeah, so it's very interesting to think about these questions about, like, what's the universe expanding into? But it turns out they're questions without meaning. It's sort of like, if you think, one of my favorite analogies to this is that we all think that if you have something, that there should be a center to it, right? You should always be able to find the center. So then, but you can break your intuition on that by saying, what's the center of the surface of the Earth? The surface of the Earth, where is the center? There is no center of the surface of the Earth. It cannot be defined. So in the same way, the idea of space having a space that it's expanding to is actually an ill-defined question, exactly the same way. I know I can't. This is supposed to help you. Just to see. So obviously it's not helping you. So just you can just ignore this. I'll hold this out, and everybody else can look at it. and just take it for what it's worth, which is a really bad problem. The point is, though, that the universe started smaller and got bigger. And at some point, it got cool enough, or like less undense enough that light could. That whereas before, whenever you had like a light ray that got emitted from some electron, then it would very quickly hit some other electron and get absorbed. And so that, but after a certain point, then whenever a light ray got emitted, and the density got low enough, so this is sort of like T1, and this is later T2, but that light ray got emitted and then never has hit anything ever again in the entire history of the universe. This is known as last scattering, or last emission of light. So it turns out that, for technical reasons that are really hard to explain, or actually not that hard to explain, but it'll probably take longer than, because I'm already halfway through my talk, that if you look, okay, so let me just stick with my story here. So okay, so you have this stuff, and so if this is true, that the universe was always expanding, and if it's true that at some point the universe went from being opaque to being, what's the opposite of opaque? Okay. Transparent, thank you. That one I really forgot. That was not the test. So it went to being transparent. If you looked up in space, what would you see? If you looked just in the direction, just any direction, would you see something? If you had a hot, if you lived in a hot gas cloud, and that gas cloud got bigger and bigger, and eventually it became a transparent gas cloud, if you looked out, would you see light coming in from all around you if you lived in the center of that gas cloud? The answer is yes. And so the whole unit, but so, and this is the part that's hard to get, wrap your intuition around, but if the whole universe is that gas cloud, then always at every time, you're looking back further and further in history, back to the surface, where this sphere in space, or actually a shell, where this the light that was went got emitted way back then, 14 billion years ago, comes and hits us. And so this is called the cosmic microwave background radiation. And it's really there. That everywhere in space, who has actually experienced having a television with an antenna? Us? Not the back row, not included. No. So those of you who have televisions with antennas have observed this. If you've ever looked at have you ever looked at a channel like one of the high channels that had got static? Yeah. So that static includes a contribution from this light that came from the Big Bang. Actually, it's about a channel. I think it's around channel 70. That something like, I can't remember, but like 10% a quarter of your interference comes from cosmological photons emitted 14 billion years ago, which is pretty cool. I think it's amazing. Anyway, and so it turns out that this CMB, which has a really good story associated with its discovery, which I'll tell you very briefly, which is that you've heard of Bell Labs. Which is Bell used to be the phone company for like the entire continent of North America. Those from not North America, Bell, which is a phone company. You probably heard, Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone. You've used telephones, yeah. Okay. Okay, so Bell Labs was a laboratory that the phone company charged exorbitant rates to everybody. And so they had lots of money. So they ran a theoretical physics lab. Why not? They invented the laser. They also discovered this cosmic microwave background radiation because they built a big telescope for looking for microwave photons. And the reason it's microwave, by the way, is because right now the peak strength of this light is in the microwave region, which is just sort of short wave. Right. Anyway, so this is just a side point to say that they built a telescope to look at microwaves for some other reason, and they kept on getting this like buzz noise in the background, which they thought was originally was from the bat guano that built up inside, but it turned out to be from the Big Bang. Pretty cool. They got a Nobel Prize. Nice to get a Nobel Prize from having a noisy experiment. But okay, that's the end of that sidestep. Anyway, so it turns out in this cosmic microwave background radiation that there's intrinsic bumpiness or anisotropy that comes from complicated reasons. But it turns out that stuff has an intrinsic length scale that you can just calculate. You know how big it is. It's like it's a particular length. It's like 50 meters. It's not 50 meters. It's way bigger than that. But you can calculate it. That's the point. And so by using that and the fact that we know how far away it is, it turns out, then you can figure out the space is flat. And so then here a lot of the way to understanding what goes into Einstein's equations for the whole universe. Turns out, but that's not quite enough. You need one more important fact. Well, you need several more important facts. But one of the important facts you need to know is that the universe is expanding, which is supposed to be the whole point of my talk. I've gone almost two-thirds of the way through, and I haven't mentioned it yet. So the universe's expansion, to go back to our triangle, is that we've been talking about the angles of the triangle so far, but not the length. So if this triangle has unit 1, 1 on each side, what's the length of this? Somebody? Richard, very good. Y'all are supposed to be the smartest high school students in the world. You should know that. So the point is that on cosmological link scales, it came to pass that all of the triangles that you try to draw, turns out that these links keep getting bigger in time. So that what looked like one unit there, is still, you kind of think of it as one unit, but like this is T1, and again T2. So the units get bigger because the universe, and this is what we mean by the universe is expanding, is that all of the link scales on these big scales keep getting bigger. What you do is you do these measurements and you try to calculate lengths, and you find that in the past everything was closer together and it's now further apart. And so then of course a natural question is how fast is it expanding now, right? And to answer that question you have to know a lot. But it turns out that So the current rate of expansion is known as, so, right, let me get, so the, it's an important question, knowing how fast the universe is expanding today. Okay? You're willing to believe that? I hope. And so it turns out the expansion rate, so, but this is, there's a problem with this current expansion rate thing, which is, if I look one light year in that direction on the sky, when was the light emitted that I see? 1 year ago, right? So therefore, everything you see in the sky is old, right? You don't know what's happening. If there's a galaxy 50 million light years away, you don't know what it's doing now. You know what it was doing 50 million years ago. So this is an intrinsic problem of cosmology, which is that you're always just looking back in time. I mean, this is kind of cool, too, but problematic. And so you come up with different ways of thinking about these things. So in particular, in this whole like how fast is the universe expanding now thing, the way that the question should be asked, as it turns out, or the most technically easy or helpful way of looking about it, just look at something and see how fast is, so if we're here, you are here. And then if you look at some galaxy over here, then if the universe is expanding, then on average you should expect every galaxy at some distance to be moving away, right? So how can you tell if something is moving away or towards you if all you can see is light coming from it? Redshift, right. So what's redshift? Somebody want to define it for me? Right. Well, it's hard to come up with a very concise definition of these things. So basically, redshift is for if something is receding from you, then it's what happens is the light, or sound coming from it, or any wave coming from it, will appear to have a lower frequency or a longer wavelength than it would if it were staying stationary. So the classic example that we all know is like if you have a car, something is driving away from you, then it sounds like it's like the wavelengths are getting longer, right? Or the frequency is getting lower. We all have this experience. Okay, so it turns out that if you look all around us in the galaxy, and not in the galaxy, if you look at all the nearby galaxies, okay, nearby galaxies are a bad case because some of them are falling towards us. But if you look at faraway galaxies, then all of them are receding at some rate. And it turns out this rate can be captured by something called the Hubble parameter, which is usually called H from Edwin Hubble, who invented it. And what it is it's a velocity. Per unit distance. That is, for an object a given distance away, how fast does it seem to be going based on how much lower its apparent frequency is? And so, if you thought very hard about the units, if this is like meters per second divided by meters, so this is really a frequency, right? It is a little weird. But as an interesting point that you can calculate for yourself, if you have something in 1/2 seconds, if you invert it, then you get something and measure it in time, right? And so it turns out that the current expansion rate, Hubble parameter, is about 1/1 the age of the universe. So you can, this is a handy way to remember what the age of the universe is. And it turns out to be about 71 was it kilometers?
Kilometers per second.
Yeah, thank you. Kilometers per second per megaparsec. Where a megaparsec is so mega is billion, and a parsec very good. So this is around 3 light years. You don't need the 2 points until you do a calculation. Okay, and so the whole story actually, I'm gonna give my first. So once you know this Hubble rate, plus the fact that the universe is flat, background curvature is flat, turns out you know a lot about the energy density of the universe. And funnily enough, so this is where we get finally in the last half hour to the point of what I'm talking about, which is that let me show you this picture first while we're on the point. But let me just go ahead and while this is coming down, tell you the next step, which is that it's really good to know what this is doing now, but it's also a very good question because these Einstein equations aren't just they're not just static equations. So they have not only is the curvature equal to the energy density, but that's also a time evolution equation. That is, if we know what the curvature and energy density are now, we can run it back and forward in time. But if you know anything about solving differential equations, which maybe you do, if you want to know how something is evolving in time, you have to know both its current value and sort of the rate of change of the current value. And so it turns out to be really important to know what the rate, what the time derivative of h is. But first, I'm going to give you this. So okay. All right. Can you all see this? Okay. So this is the Hubble value. This is the measurements. So this is just a historical plot to tell you a little bit about the history of astronomy. So it's fun. This number that's now 71, which is down here in this orange line. And so back when this was discovered in the 20s and 30s, all the calculations for this were given up here around 500. So they were way off. But the interesting thing is that these boxes represent what their estimated errors were. So the lesson of this plot, which is showing, well, there's two lessons from this plot. One is that you certainly can't use experiments as a line of extrapolation, because if you tried to put a line through this, then you'd guess that the Hubble parameter was, you know, really small, like negative, will be negative in the future, because this is not measuring the actual rate of change of h, even though that's what I was talking about. This is just bad measurements of the current h by these guys. It's not their fault. They did the best they could. It was a long time ago. But anyway, it's just sort of an interesting fact that almost everybody estimated their error and got it wrong. There's this guy, Sandage, whose error overlapped their true answer, and so did this guy, whose name I can't pronounce or even read. Anyway, but the point here is that it takes a long time sometimes to measure things, and that cosmology is improving. And also that you should never really trust astronomers' error bars. based on historical precedent. Which remains true. Oh yeah, and so, and this is, I was talking about the cosmic microwave background radiation. I know this is sort of a departure from what I was saying, but I wanted to show you some pretty pictures because some people look like they were falling asleep, and this will help them. So this is the picture of the background of the universe that I was telling you about. You may have, who's seen this picture before? Okay. So the important fact about this is that the temperature is about minus 270 degrees Celsius or centigrade, plus or minus just a little bit. So this little that bumpiness I was talking about is really small. These numbers are all really close. So if you plotted it on the same scale as like this, it would all be one color. Again, fascinating to know more about that. And so here's the point of what I was saying is that if the universe's bumpiness gets translated into whether it's flat or closed. And so it turns out that we know it's flat. The universe is flat because it has a pattern that looked most like the flat pattern that we could predict in advance. Now we go to the part that I haven't got to yet. Okay, that's enough of that. And just as another side point on physics culture, which you may have heard before, is that and Richard said that we should give you advice, and my I'll just give you my biggest piece of advice now, which is that computers are wonderful things, but shouldn't be crutches. And so even if you have computers and you learn calculus and differential equations and stuff like that, be sure that even though your teachers will not, probably many of them are convinced that computers are really important for education, that very, very often it's better for you to learn how to do it without the aid of the computer. So just insist on working harder and learning it. If you care about learning this stuff, try not to learn it with a computer. That's my whole thing. I love computers. I'm a nerd, much as I hope many of you are. But I would think that you should avoid trusting computers to do calculations for you. There are many people disagree with me on that, and this is a very big question. And much of the educational world seems to have moved to like multimedia presentations. But part of the message I'm trying to send here today is that when you're thinking about ideas, the multimedia can get in the way. Obviously, it's great to have those beautiful pictures, but don't really. I just really think that it's better you get a better contact with these ideas without relying on them. Yeah.
But could you like by hand do all the math and all that, check your results by the computer?
For most of the important things, yeah. For the things that involve intuition, the computer will never tell you you're wrong. You get a very accurate wrong answer. obviously, to do numerical questions, computers are fantastic. But the computer is never going to tell you. The computer is going to you put in some equations to a computer, say analyze this and tell me what this value is, and it'll come out 0.6. But I have to know before I started what 0.6 means and what kind of like what it means to have a flat universe and write down the equations for what flatness means before I can ever give it to a computer. And so it's very easy whenever computers are powerful to sort of like let somebody else do all those previous steps. And then get really good at the part where you tell the computer, here are the equations, and get back ever more precise measurements of how flat the universe is. But that's the part the computer can do, but that's boring. The exciting part was figuring out what flatness means. Question? Okay? Anyway, that's a little bit of philosophy for someone who's not that much older than you. Okay, so the time derivative of H. And so it turns out that the time derivative of H is equal to, so this is basically equal to, using Einstein's equations, minus times the matter density, or just not matter density, so like density plus 3 times pressure. Where, for, this is what cosmologists call density and pressure, which is a sign of, it's a funny thing. It's not really, it translates for gases. Like gases, we know that the density of a gas and its pressure are related, but they're different things, right? You have a very dense gas, and you can measure its pressure, but you also have to measure its density, and stuff like that. Anyway, but I'm just going to use this shorthand, because we all have some intuition about what density is versus what pressure is, right? So the point, though, of this equation, there's another term here, but the key point of this equation is that the change of H, the expansion rate, is a negative number times stuff that you generally think of as manifestly positive, right? I mean, the density is like the amount of stuff in a volume. And you can have, seems like you only have positive stuff. And so then you also have pressure, which we generally think of like if you have a box and if you increase the pressure, the box is going to want to get squished, right? That's what it means to have positive pressure. And so it looks like you're pretty much set here, that what gravity tells you, if gravity, gr, tells you this equation, which it does, then you're stuck having your expansion rate decrease with time. That seems to be the conclusion, right? But as it turns out, you can also measure this. You can just do these measurements of how fast things are receding, and since as we were discussing before, right? Things that are further away are further back in time. So you're always kind of measuring the rate of change of this, right? And so as it turns out, whenever you do that calculation, you find that right today, this number is greater than zero. You can do that measurement. And I'm going to tell you how you do that measurement in just a second. Actually, let me tell you now. So one of the other things I wanted to tell you about cosmology, besides all this geometry stuff, if you don't like geometry, it's okay. You don't actually do much of this geometry stuff on a day-to-day basis. You can still be a cosmologist. But one of the my favorite, in fact, thing about cosmology, without any doubt, the reason I became a cosmologist, is because there's all kinds of fascinating stuff in the universe. And because if you're a cosmologist, you get to learn about all of it. Like if you're a particle physicist, not to denigrate all of my fine colleagues who've talked to you today, they all study one thing. Like they study like string theory, or they study quantum information, and it's great. More power to them. The fun thing about being a cosmologist is that I get to talk about all this crazy geometry stuff, and then I get to talk about what I'm about to talk about, which is supernovae, or exploding stars. And it turns out that because the universe, the way that the universe works, that you have to answer questions about something really that seems really fundamental, like is space flat? You have to understand what the decay rate of nickel 56 is, which is a radioactive nucleus. And the reason why that is that, and the person who guessed about the neutron star being important for the standard ruler was onto something, is that there's objects in the universe called white dwarfs. Never remember if it's spelled with the V-E or the F, but I think it's F. F? You know? Great. White dwarfs. And so, can anyone know anything about white dwarfs here? Oh, did they all know this? Okay, somebody. Somebody has an answer before. Everybody put your hands down already. I haven't called anybody. What kind of classroom is this? You're all detention. No. You have to stay here for another week. Okay, so that's not a punishment. You'll have to go home. Okay, well, if everybody knows, I'll just tell you. So white dwarfs, balls of gas, they're just hot. That's it. They're just hot balls of gas. There's nothing really exciting about them. They're not really stars. They used to be stars in most cases. But did y'all study supernovae then? So you know about the type 1a supernovae? Yeah. Okay, great. This is easy then. I cut this time of the talk. Anyway, so white dwarfs blow up, and they all blow up with different or the same energy. same, about the same. Turns out there's a small change. So did you all learn about the small change? Okay, well, I can tell you about that part then. So white dwarf, just to review, the only way that white dwarfs can blow up is if they have some companion, some other star next to them, that's dumping gas into them until they get too heavy and they explode. And it turns out, I mean, the way that white, this is another example of how fantastically cool cosmology and astrophysics are, that white dwarfs are supported by electron pressure, which is basically, you probably heard this, but I just want to say it again, because I still think this is fascinating. The whole star is being supported by the fact that positive, like spin up and spin down electrons, you can only have two per level, right? And so an entire star that weighs much more than our sun is being supported by one kind of pressure, and that's just this quantum mechanical pressure that exists because of the fermionic properties of electrons. So you have something the size of this sun being supported by things the size of electrons. I still think that's cool. Anyway, so whenever these things explode, they explode pretty fast, but they have a light rise time and a fall time. So basically, how bright they are starts somewhere, gets high, and then goes down. And it turns out that this is the amazing discovery: is that the width of this curve is set by the amount of nickel 56 that gets produced in the explosion. Nickel 56 is just as a radioactive element that is the predominant source of their energy density. And so it turns out that all the curves have this characteristic shape, but their widths change a little bit. So the amazing thing is that the height of this curve is correlated very precisely with the width of the curve. And you can measure this, it's kind of amazing, and you can do the calculation, which is even cooler. And because of this, you can watch one of these things go off. I have a picture. But anyway, you can in real space, you can watch one of the things go off. And by measuring it over the course of several days, this is, or at least hours, I can't remember exactly, but not seconds. But you can figure out how intrinsically bright that thing is. And it turns out that that's the key fact that you need to know, which is you need to know how high it gets to the top. Because once you know that, then you can figure out how far away. You can figure out how far away it is. And the key here is that we talked about how far away things are in several ways, and I've been playing fast and loose with that. Well, this is actually one of the central questions of cosmology. Because we already agreed, right, that something that's 100 light years away is 100 years away, right? But I also like to kind of know how many meters away that is. If I strung out a string, how long would that be? And so it seems very obvious that the light travel time should give you that, right? But then you also would like to know. So it turns out the questions of like how long ago that was and how far away it is are not exactly the same in cosmology because the space is expanded in the intervening time. And let me just explain what I mean by that. Is that if you have your star go, you know, putting out light, then you draw a sphere around it, you collect all the light, right? But then you ask the question is sort of like how big is that sphere? And then but if you're in cosmology, right, this if you try to draw a sphere in space, the size is either going to be changing. And so you have to kind of ask the questions like, what do you mean, how much light's in the sphere? When? So when becomes like the when of a distance. When time and distance are intrinsically linked by these cosmological questions. And so to find out things about that happened back then, you have to know multiple facts about them to piece it together. And so it turns out to be you have to know when these supernovae happen. Okay, you have to know when these supernovae happen and also how far away. And by putting those two things together, you can figure out those are the two pieces of fact you have to put together to figure out how fast their recession is changing. So if you measure, as a function of distance away, you get h, you get here, and then here, and then here, and then like that. you can eventually build up what the rate of change of the recession velocity is. Okay? Is everyone confused by that? Okay, if you're not confused, you probably didn't pay attention. Because it's very hard. So, but you don't have to worry about it too much. This is sort of like whenever you have your full course in cosmology later in life, you'll understand this much better. But the take home is that this number, putting into Einstein's equations everything we know has to be negative. We go out and measure this number in nature, it's positive. This is frequently known as whenever this happens, you either know that you're a screw up and you did a really bad job doing your experiment, or you're about to get famous. And so it turns out the latter is at least currently in the running. But this has only been measured in the last few years, and it's one of the great mysteries of the universe, to coin a phrase. It's like, what the heck is going on that this is greater than zero? That is, what's wrong with this equation? So can anybody we have only a few minutes, but guesses about which component of this equation is wrong? People who already covered this cannot answer. Somebody, so go from this side of the room. Have a guess about which part of this equation is wrong. Or not wrong, but needs to be changed. Okay, I'll just tell you. Turns out, there's actually several answers, and there is no final, I don't know. I mean, nobody knows the answer to this. So even if you heard the current, like what people think, it may not be true, because we don't know. It turns out that the dominant idea is that the pressure isn't always positive. That in fact, pressure can be negative. And so to go back to my box example, is even though we all thought that by the definition of pressure that a box in a pressure field, like with pressure around it, could get crushed. If you put a box in a pressure field that was negative, then that box would tend to be kind of expanded. And this is very much like if you think of the opposite situation. If you had a box filled with air or a balloon full of air, and you put it in the atmosphere, it's a certain size. But then if you put it in space, where there's less pressure on the outside, it gets bigger, right? So this is sort of the opposite. Now imagine if the balloon had nothing in it. All of space was negative pressure, then the balloon would also expand. It's a bad analogy, actually. But, well, it's not so bad. Anyway, and so this is where this blowing up thing that my talk was about. Because the other, so this is what I'm, because I do my research on this, because the vexing thing about this pressure being negative, well, there's lots of vexing things about it. The first one is that, so that density I was telling you about, that's 10 to the minus 29, so the density. It turns out right now, so this is the amount of density you need to make the universe flat. But this also is the amount of, so right now of that total density. So the density in this negative pressure stuff, which is usually called this. A cosmological constant for a reason I can explain this in a second, is about 70% of that total. That is to say, about 70% of the stuff making up the background energy density of the universe, by far the most common form of energy in the entire universe, is of this bizarre form that we don't really understand. So that's kind of, I mean, it doesn't, I don't know about you, but that kind of seems like bad news to me. I mean, not bad news, but sort of a little bit slightly vexing news. It's like, you see, if someone says, don't worry, you've got $1 million in your bank account, but 70%, well, we don't actually know where it is. I mean, you wouldn't really feel like you had $1 million, would you? You should be pretty happy to have 300,000. But so this is the key, is that 70% of the energy density of the universe is in a form that has something that looks like negative pressure. It causes the universe's expansion to accelerate, and we don't know anything else about it, because that's the only way you can really measure it very well. And so my own research at the moment has to do with trying to figure out what makes this happen. And the cool thing about it, or the idea that I'm working on, which I didn't actually come up with, is that what's going on here, what might be going on here, is that we might be seeing the intrinsic size of the universe, and the universe might be have more than three spatial dimensions. So the idea is like this. So I've been talking about how this is a background energy density, sort of a density where there's nothing else. And so you know what a Fourier decomposition is, or Fourier modes? Fourier space? Okay. You know what a wavelength is? Okay. And so if you think about, like, if you had a bump that had some width W, and you tried to break that bump into the a description that of like what the characteristic size of that bump is, then you'd say the characteristic size of the bump is W, right? And so the question then is, what's the characteristic size of the background energy density of the universe? Anybody have a guess? The characteristic size of the background energy density of the universe is the size of the universe. So the current universe's size turns out to be, well, it's like 1 over h, where h is this expansion thing. So this h number comes up all over the place in cosmology. Cosmologists love it. So this is about the wavelength of this, so the lambda of the lambda, the wavelength of lambda, the cosmological constant. And since I'm almost out of time, I just should say that in this equation, the reason it's called a cosmological constant is just because this is how it enters. It's just just a sum. And so it turns out that just putting a single constant in this equation is, it looks like putting in a negative pressure. Believe me, it's weird, but it's just, that's how the equations work out. Do you have a question? Right, exactly. So that's why this is, number is important. This is the biggest number we can observe at any given time. It's how big the sphere that we can see is. So this is the biggest number we've got any experiment to do. And our experiment is the entire universe. And so, I only have a minute. Sorry. So the point is that at least in the thing I'm studying, that if you think of the universe as being enclosed in more spatial dimensions, the intuition is this. So this is the biggest wavelength we can see. We'll just call that here. And so the idea is that if you think about, we can't really get our minds around 3 dimensions plus 1. We can get our minds around 2 dimensions plus 1, because that's where we live. But if you were living a flat land person living on the surface of this table, and there were sound waves going in that table, it turns out that there's something funny that happens to sound waves propagating on a table, which is that sound waves that are smaller than the characteristic thickness of the table propagate along the table fine. They get stuck in the table and they stay. But sound waves that are longer than the characteristic thickness of the table, that is low frequency modes, tend to escape from the table pretty easily. And so they die away very fast. And so if you were a flatland dweller and you wanted to measure the amplitude of sound waves versus their wavelength, then that amplitude would be fairly flat and then it would just dialect. And so you'd find, by measuring the sound waves on your table, how thick your table is. And you would, of course, you wouldn't have any idea that that was what was going on. All you'd see is that your table has this weird property that sound waves beyond a certain size don't exist. And so the idea that I and many others are working on is that it might be that this funny stuff is happening now, because one of the other interesting fact about this is that because the universe is expanding, the density also falls off. Because as you get bigger, the density drops, right? You expand, something gets bigger. Except for this stuff. This stuff doesn't expand away. This stays the same. It's a constant. So this density is currently 70% of the total density, but in the past, it was much less than 70%. In fact, for most of the history of the universe, it was completely negligible, because this is a constant number, 10 to the minus 29. But for most of the history of the universe, the background energy density was much bigger than 10 to the minus 29. And so you could ignore this. And so, but the idea is that funny business is happening today because the universe has gotten big enough so that you can start to see it's, that it's a finite object living, a finite four-dimensional, three spatial dimensions plus a time dimension object living with more big dimensions, and that this is something like a tension of the tension on like a drum head, but like the tension of space. And it's got funny business working because the characteristic size of our four-dimension brain, or membrane, as they call it in string theory anyway, is now getting to the point where the wavelengths that we can observe, that is the whole universe that we can observe today, are not the fundamentally biggest wavelengths, but they're starting to act funny because the wavelengths today are about the same size as the fundamental object that we all live on. And so I'm going to have to close with that, which is no explanation at all. But it's just to tell you that it's possible, however, perhaps unlikely, that this could be observational evidence for extra dimensions, but we don't know yet. So thank you very much.
Would that still be true if we measure things in terms of atoms?
No. This is an excellent question, and I didn't explain that very well. The size of stuff stays the same. If inside of this water bottle, this will always be the same size. Okay. The funny thing is that it's sort of like the space between that stretches, the space between things. The intrinsic size scale of stuff is fixed by other phenomena, but the space scale between things is being affected.
So the space between the Earth and the Moon gets larger, but not the Earth and the Moon themselves?
Well, that would be true, except that the Earth and the Moon are kept at a certain distance by other things. So these background effects are actually pretty small. The Earth and the Moon you could think of them as being very slightly pulled apart, but that the force of them being pulled apart is so small that you can ignore it. But it only gets important for very long scales. It's hard to get your head around this. I mean, I have trouble grabbing it myself.
Recently I read about this thing called dark fluid. Have you studied much about that?
This just as an explanation for this?
Well, it says that dark matter and dark energy are two sides of the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be Cassegrain gas. Is that another term for it? It's named after the guy. I think this is a spelling. Mm-hmm. So this is, y'all heard about dark matter from somebody?
No.
Okay. What?
Next.
Oh, is that next? Okay, you're gonna hear about dark matter next. But this is basically, some people like the idea, it's like, dark matter is the other big mystery of the universe at the moment. It's matter we can't see. You're gonna hear about it more later. But this is the idea that you can just roll these two problems together. You just say, well, we don't know what this is, we don't know what that is. So maybe they're the same thing, we don't know what they are. And so, but the problem is that, the problem with that is that I don't know. It could be true. The problem is that it's not really neat. Other than that, this what I just said, which is just like two mysteries. If you put two mysteries into one, then you look like you only have one mystery left. So that's pretty much the only reason for doing it. Any other questions?
Okay. So let's thank Mark.